Jay? All righty. Well, welcome to our Bible class. It's 3:30, and we spend time on Sunday afternoons between 3:30 and about 4:10, 4:15 to go through a book of the Old Testament. We've been going through from Genesis now all the way to the book of Ezekiel. And what a blessing this has been to all of us who've been reading the Scriptures together during the course of the week and spending time privately reading the Bible and looking through, especially when we get into these prophets. What an absolute blessing it is to read their story. So many times we will kind of bypass some of the prophets because of the difficulties of the book, but it's worth it. It's absolutely worth it to dig in and try to wade through and think through with the prophet what he had to go through to be able to speak God's message to God's people. And when we come to the book of Ezekiel tonight, I want us to realize just how blessed we are in the world that we live in compared to the world that he lived in. If we think we've got it bad during the coronavirus stuff, can you imagine living in a time and a day when your own people are being slaughtered? We're going to see in just a few moments, he was 13 years old when he was ripped out of his homeland and taken into captivity. And can you imagine what that would be like? He was 13 when Josiah came to an end, but he was 25 when he was ripped out and taken into captivity. And so he lived to see a lot of things in his young life. And so we're going to spend some time studying his life. So if you would, bow with me in prayer as we begin our class. Oh, Lord, our God, what a joy it is that we can open your book and see one of these great prophets from times past, your servants, the prophets, and be able to see the life of men like Jeremiah and Isaiah and Ezekiel and Daniel. What a joy it is, Father, as we look into their lives to realize how blessed we are and how comforted we are by your hand in this place in which we live. But, Father, help us to go back in time and walk where they walked and sit where they sit and to realize what they had to do to be faithful to you. Father, in the day and age in which they lived and how difficult it must have been to be a prophet of God in those days. We're grateful, Father, for the opportunity we have now to read and study together and help us to grow in our faith because of it. In Jesus' name, amen. As we look at the man Ezekiel, we can remember, as I'm sure we've been doing already in the past, we have been, going back and remembering the timeline in which all this comes about. In 606, we remember God had sent Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar to come and take the people away. They had been warned and warned and warned and warned, and they would not listen. And God said, enough is enough. And so he sends Nebuchadnezzar and his army down to from the north to take the people and take them into captivity. And among those were men like Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And we already have we know their story a little bit better than we know Ezekiel's and others. And we'll get into that, in fact, next week. That'll be the next week's study is Daniel. But just to kind of give you a picture of that and what that was like is when they got hauled off into captivity, and then we find 11 years later, Ezekiel, as we're going to look at him tonight, is taken into captivity. And then 11 years later after that, we're going to find that Jeremiah was the prophet of that day, left behind in the area of Judah to preach and to prophesy to them. And we've already studied his story and his life. And there, of course, we see that Jerusalem was actually destroyed. So we're kind of flipping around. We've already had Jeremiah and Lamentations, and we see what happened to the city itself. But now we kind of go back in time a little bit and pick up with the story of Ezekiel before that actually happened, because Ezekiel was already in captivity for those 11 years before the destruction of Jerusalem. So kind of get a picture of that, the captivity that began in 606, when Daniel and others were carried away, would last until 536, when Cyrus the Great would allow for there to be a return, a restoration, a going back to the land itself and building the walls and building the temple and reinstituting the worship of God in the city of Jerusalem. And so kind of get a time frame of that. Ezekiel, we're going to find, is prophesying beginning in 592. He's carried into captivity in 597, so you have to think backwards in the way they, because we're not going, instead of going forward, you have to count back. 597, 96, 95, 94, 93, then 92, 5 years into captivity, God calls Ezekiel to begin to prophesy. And he will prophesy for 70 years. I mean, for until 570, for 22 years. And so that's kind of the picture we're going to have. Looking at the man himself, Ezekiel, the very name was given to him. It was means God will strengthen, or God is strong, or God gives you strength. And we're going to see that God is certainly going to give him strength to endure some horrible, horrible things as he prophesies to the people in captivity by the river Kebar in Babylon. We see in Ezekiel's life, he was born in 622. It's really easy to kind of tag the years here. Some of these prophets are hard to really locate the exact time. But in the case of Ezekiel, he gives us exactly the time. And so it makes it very easy to be able to designate when. And he tells us how old he was at 30 years of age when he's prophesying. You go back 5 years when he went into captivity. And so if we know his age, then we can go back to the actual year when he was born. So in 622 B.C., Ezekiel came into this world. He goes into captivity in 597 at the age of 25. And then in 5 years after that, he begins to prophesy. God comes to him in the whirlwind, and he begins to prophesy to him in 592, and he will prophesy till from the age 30 to age 52. So that kind of gives you an idea of kind of a picture of the man, that he's 30 years old, 25 when he's hauled off into captivity in chains, and he gets there, and they send him 60 miles north to this little place called off the river Kebar, and there he's going to sit where these people are. And then 5 years into that, when all the woe is me's are part of their lifestyle, God will come to the prophet and say, in a very graphic whirlwind, and give him a picture of the greatness and the glory of God, and he will tell him, now I'm calling you to preach to these people. So his home would be in a little place near the river Kebar in a little town called Tel Abib. Not Tel Aviv, but Tel Abib. And there he will sit in this area right off of a kind of a tributary of the Euphrates River. In fact, I'm going to show you a picture of that here. You can see but the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers are the two big rivers going from the south to the north there. And on the Euphrates would be right where the Kebar, where the city of Tel Aviv is, and the tributary of the Kebar River, or really more of a creek, comes off of that. About a mile or so off of the river itself is where Tel Aviv is. And that's where Ezekiel has been placed by the Babylonians, and those other people that he's with are up in this kind of a Jewish settlement is where this is up on in this area. And so you can think about it as going 60 miles north of Babylon itself is where he's sitting. And so you think, well, he's not that far from Babylon, but you might as well be a million miles away, because if you're in a Jewish settlement, it's like when they used to put the Indians on the reservations, you weren't supposed to get off the reservation. And so he was settled there, and he wasn't supposed to be moving around. That's the way they did with these Jews there. So that kind of gives you a picture. He's sitting there and he's thinking about all the agony that's gone on into his people and his land. Look at the kings that would be a part of Josiah's life. He was born during the reign of Josiah. And we know the study of Josiah. He was the boy king who became a great king. And he did a lot of good things in his life, a lot of the restorations. We've already studied a little bit about Josiah in that regard. And he was doing some good things. There were some restorations, the finding of the book and the restoration of things, going back to the worship of God. And Ezekiel would have been a teenager when Josiah is killed by Pharaoh Necho. And so here he is. He's about 13 at this time. So think of a teenager. Kind of picture that in your mind. And so he's lived through at least a good king in that regard. And he no doubt would have come from a decent family. He was a priest. In fact, he was from the priestly family from the tribe of Levi. The Bible tells us that he was a priest. And so he would have grown up. His father would have been one maybe who went and worked in the temple complex. And so get a picture of Ezekiel later when he's sitting in the Kebar, thinking back to the times that he would have been in Jerusalem, and his dad would have maybe done some service in the temple complex. And now he's going to have to prophesy of the destruction that's going to come to the very homeland in which he grew up. Jehoahaz, of course, he didn't last very long, about 3 months, and so he was there in his reign. And then Jehoiakim was put in his place by Nebuchadnezzar, and he would reign till this carrying away in 597 after Jehoiakim rebelled. And so for the age of about 13 to the age of about 25, he's there with Jehoiakim, or he's alive with in the area with the king Jehoiakim. And then, of course, Jehoiakim is taken off, and Jehoiachin is placed there. It is, so at the age of 25, when he's being carried off, Jehoiachin has been placed there as a vassal king by Nebuchadnezzar. Zedekiah in 597, Jehoiachin didn't last long. Then Zedekiah was there from 597 to 586. And so from the age of 25 to the age of about 36 in Ezekiel's life, Zedekiah would have been on the throne. And then after Zedekiah had rebelled and they took care of him, then Gedaliah was placed there as a kind of a vassal governor in at the age of 36, when Ezekiel was 36 years old. So that kind of gives you a picture of Ezekiel, his the chronology that would be there. But then look at the state of Israel itself, or state of Judah, really, during this period of time. We already have gone on through a lot of this as we studied 1st and 2nd Kings. When we studied those books, we saw the kind of mindset that Israel had devolved into, and it was terrible. They had been allied with all these other nations, particularly Egypt. They didn't depend upon God. They depended upon other nations to bail them out, and especially did they take their security in the fact that the temple was still there. And as long as the temple was still there, they would have great security. They thought, well, as long as the temple's here, God's with us. No matter how bad it gets, the temple's here, so everything's good. And of course, God's going to make sure that doesn't continue. And the very fact that they're here taking their kids and offering them to Moloch and some of these other gods, they had forgot God, they'd forgot the law, and there was no mercy or justice by the people in the land. So get that picture how desperate it had become and why God finally said, enough is enough. And so he's going to send Nebuchadnezzar's army down to take care of that. So get this picture. They're being hauled off into captivity, and Ezekiel is now up on the River Kibar in the Tel Abib area off the Euphrates. And as we see Ezekiel prophesy during the course of these 48 chapters, it's interesting as you go back and read that to see how God shows himself and how Ezekiel sees God. It's really an eye-opening experience to be able to go back as you read these chapters to see how God shows himself, like in the first chapter in the whirlwind. And we're going to see many other illustrations of that as the book unfolds, that God telling Ezekiel, you tell them I am this, and you tell them I am that, that I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. And so you see the omnipotence of God, that he has control over the nations. You have the omniscience of God, that he can see the end from the beginning, the omnipresence of God. And we can look at some of those chapters and verses later, and even God coming down in times and saying, I'm showing no mercy and no pity. I'm going to judge you, and there's going to be a terrible judgment, and I'm jealous for my people. And so going through the book and reading it with the idea of trying to discover God is really an interesting study. I'm going to show you a chart now that Andy uses often, and I want you to look at it with me. As we look at this chart and kind of get a bigger picture, a 10,000-foot view of the book of Ezekiel, you can see, particularly over on the left-hand side, the quote that I've got there from chapter 33, verse 21, where it talks about the city has been captured. This was a messenger had run from Jerusalem all the way back to the area where Ezekiel was. And this messenger shows up. And he comes in and he probably in a huff and a puff, and he's, you know, winded. And as he's yelling, he's saying, the city has been captured. Can you imagine the dispirited feelings that they were having? Ezekiel had been prophesying it was going to happen, but now the word is there that it has happened and the destruction has taken place. And so get a picture of that and how the people would have got that news and how distraught they would have been over that news. And yet that's where Ezekiel starts and says, oh, but, yes, those things have happened, but here's what God's got planned. And beginning in chapter 33 all the way to the end of the book, we can see the good stuff that God has got planned for the people of Judah, the restoration back to the land in years to come. So looking at this, the book itself, you can see that he is a prophet to the captives. That's where his job is. He's going to sit on the River Kibar, and the people would probably come around to him, and he would preach, and they wouldn't like his message very well. Like all the other prophets, when God sends them to do a message, he says, I hope that they'll listen to you, but they're really not going to. And so it's going to be a good news, bad news. Some will take what you have to say, and they'll thank you for it. But the vast majority are going to hate you for this. And so please remember that it's no joy to be a prophet of God. We already know from our studies of the Bible, how the prophets, Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount talked about you will receive a prophet's reward. You know what he's meant by that? He was talking in the midst of suffering and persecutions and trials. And the prophets who would be killed from the blood of Abel to the blood of Zechariah the prophet, he's basically saying the prophet's reward is if they were faithful to the message and they were killed in the doing of it, God will give them a special reward. And that's, of course, exactly what Jesus was referring to. I want a prophet's reward without having to go through what a prophet did, tell you the truth. And I want an apostle's reward without having to go through what the apostles went through. Paul would outline all the terrible things that apostles had to endure. So the apostles and prophets were people that were so special to God because they were sent to talk to and try to convert people to a message they didn't want to hear. And that's no different than our day and age as well in that regard. Looking at it from the big picture, from the first 32 chapters, it's basically God saying, I'm bringing judgment. I'm going to bring judgment upon the people. The nation is going to be carried into captivity. Ultimately, a few years later, Ezekiel's been prophesying, the city is going to fall, and the temple is going to be destroyed. And so God's bringing his judgment. So the prophecies of destruction, he's basically saying, the Lord is not in your midst. He has left you. The Lord has left you. And in the midst of that, there's judgments against Judah. And for at least the first 24 chapters, particularly chapter 24, when Ezekiel's wife has to die for him to learn a hard lesson. And then in chapter 25 through 32, so those things were happening before the fall, and the Lord's glory had departed from them. And so this is a period of about 7 years. So from 592, and you count to about 586, those periods of that period of time is when he's telling this is going to happen. The judgment's coming down on the city of Jerusalem. It's going to be a horrible situation. And so for 7 years, he's giving them a heads up what God has planned, what God is going to do to the city of Jerusalem. It's not going to be a pretty thing. But then as he does it, he's also going to spend time saying, but you know, God's also bringing judgments on other nations as well. Edom, Ammon, Egypt, the Philistines. God's going to bring judgments upon the city of Tyre and the nation of that area. God's bringing judgments upon all of them as well. And so those who stand to gloat when Israel falls, when Jerusalem falls, God will bring judgment on them too. And then later he would say he's going to bring judgment even on Babylon itself for what they did. And so get that picture. The first half of the book, the first part of the book anyway, the first 32 chapters, he's giving the future tense about what's about to happen to the city, and so they can be prepared. But then you have that turnaround in chapter 33 when it says the city is captured and everybody's going, oh no, oh no, oh no. And they sat down on the river and the people would mock them and say, sing to us the songs of Zion. And, when they sat by the river, Psalm 137. And so it would have been a horrible time, but he turns and he says, but guys, cheer up. Here's the good news. And so from chapter 33 all the way to the rest of the book, he's giving a bigger, better picture of what's to come. And so you got to read the book all the way through to appreciate what God is doing here. It's easy in our time and age to look at the things that are going wrong, that the problems happening in here in America, but to know that God is in control, that what's happening in our life, there's a future. There's always a future ahead, and God's in control of that future. And that's one of the joys I get from reading a book like this. The world that doesn't read the Bible, the world that doesn't see that God is the creator and he's the sustainer of the earth, then it's easy to get depressed. It's easy to get down and say, life stinks and God, what are you doing? When you go back and read the prophets, you realize God's always doing something that's leading ultimately to his end, to what he wants. And so I appreciate so much as I've read this book to be able then to take that last part of that chapter and to see the good that God would yet do for the nation and the good that he will do for us too. So he's promising the restoration. And the very last verse of the book itself, chapter 48 and in verse 35, it ends with these capital letters, at least in my Bible. It says, the Lord is there. The Lord was gone in the first part. He left them. He says, I'm no longer your God. You've forgotten me. I'm going to let you go. But there will be a time and an age, and it would come in the days of the Messiah, that the Lord will be there and that there will be better days ahead. And I need to be reminded of that, So for the last 15 years of his ministry, we see that Ezekiel is giving good news about what's yet to come. And we need to be reminded of that, that one day the Lord's coming back and his glory is going to be displayed. And we are anticipating that. And so we say, Lord, come. And so I look forward to those moments. I mentioned a moment ago in Psalm 137, I want to read this passage. We've read it already in the previous studies, but I want you to see it again. In Psalm 137, verses 1 through 4, by the rivers of Babylon, there's Ezekiel, by the way, by the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down. Yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. So remember, just imagine this servant just runs up and says, the city has been captured. And everybody starts, starts crying and weeping and wailing and lamenting. And soon they would have people being brought to them from that captivity in 586. And so this picture in your mind, he says, we hung our harps upon the willows in the midst of it. In other words, you get the picture on the river, you got all these trees and the willow trees and things, and they don't want to play music anymore. The joy is gone, and they just want to hang their instruments up and no longer think about that. But he says, for there those who carried us away captive. So here's their captors. Ask of us a song, and those who plundered us requested mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. They're mocking them. That's what they're doing. They're just mocking them. Sing us one of the songs of Zion. Sing us the old rugged cross. Sing. They wouldn't have said that one, but sing us one of the songs that we would have loved to have sung. And we said, I don't feel like singing. Oh, come on. And they're just mocking them. They're just goading them on. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? God's left us. Why? What's the point of the singing? There's no hope. We've lost it all. And it's going to be as men like Ezekiel are going to come along and say, start singing again. Pull those harps off the willow trees and begin to play and sing. God's got a plan, and we're going to be a part of that plan. We might not live to see it, but our children and our grandchildren will. Because Jeremiah and others had already said 70 years. The clock had already started ticking. In 606, when Ezekiel was prophesying, the clock was already ticking. They already had said 70 years. And so Ezekiel could look at that and be reminded, hey, 606, 536, God's going to do something to bring us back. And so they had the messages from the prophets to be able to look to the future and to realize that God was in control. And so he'd already kept his promises and other things. And so even when he says, I'm sending this nation from the north to get you, that should have told them God's in control. One of the downsides of the reread the book is the most depressing to me, a married man, as you look at chapter 24, that God comes and he says, these people need to be reminded. He'd been setting him up and saying, I want you to lay on your side for 390 days, and then on your other side for 40 days, and I'm going to teach you a lesson by that. I want you to build a model of a siege of a city, and when they ask you the question, I want you to tell them all about that siege. And he had him do all kinds of things through the book, weird things through the book. And they would go, what are you doing? And he goes, glad you asked. And I'm going to tell you all about what I just did. Why did I sit on my side for 390 days? Why did I sit on my side for this time? Why did I build this model? And so he'd tell them the story of what God had it planned. And they would, many of them would mock him because he said most of them, well, God even told him, most of them would refuse what you're going to say. They're not going to believe you because they don't believe me. They're not going to listen to you because they don't listen to me. But one time, the most graphic of all illustrations is going to come. In chapter 24, I'm going to read you, it says, also the word of the Lord came to me, saying, son of man, behold, I take away from you the desire of your eyes with one stroke. Yet you shall neither mourn nor weep, nor shall your tears run down. Sigh in silence, make no mourning for the dead. Bind your turban on your head, put your sandals on your feet. Do not cover your lips, and do not eat man's bread of sorrow. So I spoke to the people in the morning and at evening, the desire of my eyes. My wife died. And the next morning I did as I was commanded. I don't know about you. That's far worse than what Hosea had to go through when his wife ran off into harlotry and he had to go buy her off the auction block and bring her back. And what a horrible experience that must have been. But in this case, can you imagine? He says, I want you to do something that's going to be the most difficult thing you've ever been through. I want you to, in one stroke, your wife's going to die. There's not even going to be any forewarning. It's just going to happen. And when that happens, you can't cry. And people are going to ask, why aren't you mourning for your wife? Wasn't she the desire of your eyes? Wasn't she the wife of your youth? And you can't even mourn for her. You're not even to shed a tear. And they're going to ask you about that, and you're going to be able to tell them that's exactly how God feels. You've turned against Him, and God's going to take away your people, or going to take away your city, and you're not even going to mourn over this. Thinking about what he asked him to do. So I wanted to just use that as an illustration about getting into the mindset of Ezekiel. My purpose in this particular class is to help you to appreciate the prophet himself. We don't have time to cover 48 chapters. No way, Jose. We just can't do that. So what I want you to do is I want you to feel for Ezekiel. I want you to feel the man and what he goes through. Take your Bible to Ezekiel 1. I want to show you. In chapters 1, 2, and 3, kind of give you a picture of what he's doing here. In chapter 1, I want to just begin the first few verses here. And so, get this picture. He's 30 years old. That's what I think this passage is saying. It came to pass in the 30th year, I think he's talking about his life, in the fourth month, on the fifth day of the month, as I was among the captives by the river Kebar, that the heavens were open and I saw visions of God. On the fifth day of the month, which was in the fifth year of the king Jehoiachin's captivity, the word of the Lord came expressly to Ezekiel the priest, the son of Buzi, and the land of the Chaldeans by the river Kebar, and the hand of the Lord was upon him there. Picture this. Here's a man who grew up excited. His dad worked probably in the temple area. He did sacrifices, and he's going to be that too, but now all of a sudden he never gets to be the priest. At 25 years of age, usually at the age of 30 is when you began to work as a priest. He never got a chance to do that, what he probably longed to do all of his life. And now here he sits kind of as a priest of God in a foreign land. And as he's there, it says God comes upon him and puts his hand upon him. And I want you to get that picture. God coming down and he puts his hand upon Ezekiel. The Spirit of God comes down and he does this. Now, I know it's probably not literal, but he feels the weight of God's hand come upon him. And he then begins to tell him, I got a job for you to do. And says, but before I tell you what I want you to say, I want you to see me. I want you to see who I am and who it is that's speaking to you. And so what he does is then he sends this whirlwind, this tornado, as it were, and it comes down in one of the strangest scenes you've ever seen anywhere. Apocalyptic language in an extraordinary way. When he comes down, he shows him this great wind, whirlwind. And out of this whirlwind comes this wheel within a wheel. And it's circular. And it seems to be basically the omniscience and omnipresence and omnipotence all rolled into one of God. You're able to see that wherever he goes, he's going forward, as it were. And whatever he says is going to be true. And so Ezekiel is going to be so overwhelmed by this picture that he falls down as a dead man. And you're going to get the same image you'd get with John later in the book of Revelation, where he falls as one is dead and he has to be told to rise and go about your work. And so Ezekiel and John have a lot in common. The apocalyptic literature, John's going to take a lot of things out of Ezekiel and put it into his book by the hand of God. But God's hand comes upon him. That leads you to the next, in chapter 2. If you look over in chapter 2, look at the last verse of chapter 1. So when I saw it, I fell on my face and I heard a voice of one speaking. So he's got this image of this spectacular picture of God and he falls down like any of us would do and he's just mesmerized by it and awestruck by it. And then he says, and he said to me, Son of Man, which is his favorite phrase for God, for Ezekiel, stand on your feet and I will speak to you. And the Spirit entered me when he spoke to me and set me on my feet, and I heard him who spoke to me. And he said to me, Son of man, I am sending you to the children of Israel, to a rebellious nation that has rebelled against me. They and their fathers have transgressed against me to this very day. The point I want you to see here, without reading the rest of the chapter, is this, that God's hand has come upon him. He brings him this incredible image. And then he says, now that you know who I'm speaking to you, I'm going to tell you what I'm going to tell you something. I'm going to tell you what you need to go say. And so he puts now the word in him. So he's been put his hand upon him. Now he puts the word of God in him. And he says, now, you have this message, go tell the people. All those people that are in this Jewish community by the river Kibar, I want you to get up and start prophesying. I want you to start predicting what's to happen in the future. And so he does. And that moves you, and we're going to get into some other things in two in just a moment. In chapter 3, if you look in chapter 3, and as he picks up the story, he says in verse 1, moreover, he says to me, son of man, eat what you find. Eat this scroll, everything that he's been telling him up to now. He says, eat it, go, number 2, and then number 3, speak to the house of Israel. So I opened my mouth, and he calls me to eat that scroll. And he said to me, son of man, feed your belly and fill your stomach with this scroll that I give you. So I ate it, and it was in my mouth like honey and sweetness. You ever seen that picture before? That picture's in John as well, in his revelation. So he tells him everything I'm going to tell you. You know why he had sweetness to his mouth when he ate it? It wasn't because of the first 25, 32, 32 chapters, because those were bitter. It was what, after he got the big picture, I think what he has is the sweetness was that God was going to bring restoration, that God was going to ultimately, as he sees the big picture of the book, before he even prophesies all this stuff, he's going to know that God's in control and that God, this all-powerful being, is going to do something about all of this, that there will not be an end to the nation of Israel, that God has a plan and a purpose. And so now he says, now go and speak. And so now God speaks through him. So God puts his hand upon him. He speaks to him what he wants him to say. And then he says, go and I'll speak through you. So that's what a prophet is. The word prophet itself means a mouth, a spokesman, somebody who speaks for God. And that's what he is doing here. And what I like particularly about chapter 3, if you skip down to verse 10, he says, moreover, he said to me, son of man, receive into your heart all my words that I speak to you and hear with your ears. Listen to what I'm saying, Ezekiel. And then, here he says it again, go. Go get to the captives, to the children of your people, and speak to them and tell them, thus says the Lord God, whether they hear or whether they refuse. Isn't that true with most preachers of the gospel, preachers of the word of God? That there's going to be some who will listen, but the vast majority are going to refuse. They're going to heap to themselves teachers having itching ears, as we're going to see in 2 Timothy chapter 4. It's ever been that way with God's message. God has good news. He's got bad news. He tells you the bad news that you're a sinner, but he tells you the good news that you can be saved. The vast majority of the people don't want to hear that they are in sin, and they don't want to hear even the bad news. They won't even be told that I'm a sinner. Leave me alone. So you don't even get to the message of salvation because they don't want to hear. And what they do is they turn on the messenger. As they did the prophets, they will do it to us today. And so we need to be aware of that as we read this story of this. And so I just wanted to go back and rehearse that again. So in chapter 1, we're looking at he comes to him and speaks to him out of the whirlwind. He puts his hand upon Ezekiel. In chapter 2, as we've just read, he comes and he speaks to Ezekiel. And then in chapter 3, he speaks through Ezekiel. So I want you to kind of get that picture without, we don't have time this afternoon to go through all the messages. That's going to be left up to you in your reading. But look at what God is doing through this man. Ultimately, you get down to verse 15 of chapter 3, and I want you to see this. In chapter, verse 14, so the Spirit lifted me up and took me away, and I went in bitterness in the heat of my spirit, but the hand of the Lord was strong upon me. In other words, he felt God's presence. Then I came to the captives at Tel Abib, who dwelt by the river Kibar. And I love this statement. I sat where they sat, and I remained there astonished among them 7 days. Get this picture. It's like Jeremiah. He was a prophet of the people. He wasn't like Daniel up in the temple or in the courtyard, but he was down among the people. He sat where they sat. He goes and he lives among them. He lived in these little mud huts, probably like they lived in a little mud hut. He drank from the river water that would probably be dirty, and just like they did. He had a hard life, and he says, I sat where they sat, and I know what you're going through. I got stripped of all my future when I got ripped out of Jerusalem as well. And they're all crying, and they've hung their harps on the willow trees, and they're not singing anymore, and it's just a terrible situation. But one of the things he knows he has to do is he has to tell them God's word, and it's not going to get any better anytime soon. Make yourself comfortable because this will be your home probably till the day you die. But your children and your children's children are going to get a chance to go back. So that's the good news. So I want you to pick up in verse 16, where he says, "Now it came to pass at the end of the 7 days, after he sat just among them," just sort of like Job's comforter sat for 7 days and didn't say anything. And then when they did speak, it was bad. But in this case, he has to speak God's message. So he sits for a week, doesn't say anything. They're all crying. The tears are flowing. Their hearts are broken. "And it came to pass at the end of 7 days that the word of the Lord came to me, saying, 'Son of man, I have made you a watchman for the house of Israel. Therefore, hear a word from my mouth and give them warning from me. When I say to the wicked, you shall surely die, and you give him no warning, nor speak to warn the wicked from his wicked way to save his life, that same wicked man shall die in his iniquity. But his blood I'll require at your hand. Yet, if you warn the wicked, and he does not turn from his wickedness and from his wicked way, he shall die in his iniquity, but you have delivered your soul. Again, when a righteous man turns from the righteousness and commits iniquity, and I lay a stumbling block before him, he shall die. Because you did not give him a warning, he shall die in his sin, and his righteousness which he has done shall not be remembered, but his blood I will require at your hand. Nevertheless, if you warn the righteous man that the righteous should not sin, and he does not sin, he shall surely live because he took warning. Also, you will have delivered your soul.'" As a gospel preacher, every preacher reads that passage. As a shepherd of the flock, every shepherd should read that passage. God is saying in no uncertain terms, "I'm requiring the souls." When I think of Hebrews chapter 13, verse 7 and verse 17, an elder of the church, he is accountable before God for the flock upon which he is to be a shepherd. And I read that, and every shepherd ought to read that passage. Every preacher ought to preach that, or read that passage. That my job is to preach the word in season and out of season, to reprove, rebuke, and exhort. Whether they listen or whether they don't is beside the point. My job is to be a watchman on the wall. In chapter 4, he then goes about putting up a model, and everybody's supposed to come and ask him, "What are you doing with this model?" And this, like we when I was a boy, putting up these cities, and then you set up army men, and then you come in and knock it over. And he says, why'd you do that? And he says, glad you asked me that question. Here's what's about to happen in basically 586. In a few years to come, there's going to be this great siege. These Babylonians that we're living among, they're going to send their army right back down. And finally, it's going to lay siege to the city, and it's going to be destroyed. And the temple itself is going down. It's going to be burned to the ground. And so they're going, "That can't be. That can't possibly be." And he says, "Oh, yeah, it is. That's exactly what's going to happen." Here's what God has said through Ezekiel. If you go and read the big picture of the book, he's saying God designed Jerusalem, and particularly the Jewish people, to be a light to the world, to light to the nations. And all these other nations, I mean, look at the locality of where God placed them. Right in the midst of Egypt on one side, and you got the Syrians, the Arams on the other, and you got Ammon and Moab and Edom and Canaan. And then you got the Assyrians and the Babylonians. You got all these nations that surround Israel. And you're supposed to be in the midst of the very middle of them, you're supposed to be a light to the world. And yet you have put out the light. It's nothing but pure darkness. And nobody is looking to God through you when your job was to show God through you. And they didn't do it. And so God says, "Well, if you're going to put the light out, I'm going to remove the candlestick." And you see how that works with Revelation? Chapters 2 and 3, if you don't change your ways, I'm going to come and remove the candlestick from you. And that's exactly what Ezekiel is doing here. That's his purpose. Notice if you go through the book, particularly the first 24 chapters, how God lays it out in matters of year, month, and days. We would say it in our day, in the year 5, it would be April the 5th. God speaks the first 7 chapters of Ezekiel in one day. And then June the 5th, in the next year, he speaks chapters 8 through 19. And then in year 7, beginning in chapter 20, he says basically on May the 10th, as we would look at it, and he gives the description of chapters 20 through 23. And then in the year 9, on October the 10th, he gives this 24th chapter, and that's the day that October the 10th is the day his wife died. That's when his wife would have died in one stroke in one moment of time. And that's when he gives chapter 24, which is the chapter of his wife's death. And so get this picture that he lays this out chronologically and tells you when he's prophesying these things for these seven years leading up to the destruction. And even during this period of time, in chapters 25 through 32, he prophesies about what's to happen to the nations. There's Ammon and Moab and Edom and the Philistines, and they had all kind of mocked Israel for you know, what happened to them. And God says, well, I'll take care of you too later on. In fact, the book of Obadiah is about what he does to Edom. And then what comes back and what the Tyre and what they did. So he gives three chapters of prophecy about what he would do to the city of Tyre, what it would be laid waste, and it was. And then finally, in chapters 29 through 32, what he's going to do to Egypt, who had turned against his people. And so with all that said, the judgments against those nations, the latter part of the chapter, and we'll finish our study this morning or this afternoon with this, as you look at these chapters, chapters 33 through 48, here's where the sun comes back up. The sun has gone down in its total darkness in those, as he prophesies, especially when his wife dies and they have to ask him those things. But now if you start looking at, starting in chapter 33, the dawn has broken and you begin to see the sunshine as he looks into the future and realizes that the messianic age is coming. And boy, the apocalyptic language in these chapters foretelling the coming of Jesus Christ and the glory that was going to come. It wasn't just God's glory in the resurrection of the temple and the resurrection of the people of Israel. That's not what the joy was. The joy was God's plan that there would come a time and a place where the Messiah would come, and he would be the morning star, and he would be the one that would give light and glory to the whole world, not just the people of Israel. So God still had a place for the people of Israel, but that place was simply to be a placeholder until Jesus comes into the world. And Ezekiel's going to tell you that through these last chapters. And so for those who trusted in God and believed in God, there was a better day coming. For those who didn't, and most didn't, they listened to what Ezekiel said and they laughed at him. And they mocked him for that. But in chapter 33 is the story of the watchman again, and that's what he did back in chapter 3. But in chapter 33, if you skip back over to there, I love this myself personally as a preacher of the gospel and as an elder in the church. When you look at that chapter and you see that, particularly him being a priest, he would look at it from that angle, that our job was be to teach the Bible. That's what priests were supposed to be, spiritual leaders for the people. And they had failed to do it. The shepherds no longer cared about the sheep anymore. And he tells that story in this chapter. And he says, here's what we should have done. And so Ezekiel looking at it through the eye of a priest, saying, that would have been my job. My dad's job would have been to show the people God and to offer the sacrifices and to restore the law of God back to the people. But they had lost all that. But the duty of the watchman, and I love it, where my job, all of our jobs as watchmen, are to teach the Bible to a lost and dying world. And like we read back in chapter 3, God would hold that blood upon me if I didn't warn what needed to be warned. If I did give warning and they rejected me, then their blood is on them, not on me. But if I didn't give warning, then their blood is on me. And that's a scary thought to me, to think that my job is to preach the word, to be urgent in season and out of season. What he told Ezekiel was, some are going to accept you, most are going to refuse you. That's preaching in season and out of season. That's exactly what that means. Let's look at that story. We look at some of the key lessons. I love it. I've got a piece of paper. I've got, in fact, a whole bunch of pieces of paper up here, 10 pages. And what I did, I just simply went back and typed up I cut and pasted, every single time, 92 times, where he talked about, then you will know that I am the Lord, or a phrase similar to that, like, I am the Lord, I have spoken, and it will come to pass. And so many, many times, 92 times in the book itself, and I think that makes it the key to the book itself. Then you will know. I'm going to do this. When you see this, then you'll know that I'm the Lord. That's what a prophet does. A prophet can foretell the future through the eyes of God. God can see the future where we came. And he says, when you hear this happen, you're going to know that I'm the Lord. When he takes away that nation, Edom or Ammon or whatever, you will know that I'm the Lord. A powerful nation like Egypt that seemed to be insurmountable in their army, he says, they're going to be gone, and then you'll know that I'm the Lord. Babylon itself will one day know that I am the Lord when they're carried away. And so all those times you need to go back and highlight into 48 chapters, there's 92 times that God says something to the effect that then you'll know that I'm the Lord. So prophecy is the key. Other key lessons in the book is, my eye will not spare. Five times he says that. My eye will not spare, nor will I show pity. His phrase for Ezekiel was, he was the Son of Man. That's going to be a character trait of Jesus Christ. We know that. Jesus, in fact, in the Gospel of Luke, tells that's the name he gives to himself over and over again. The Son of Man says, the Son of Man says, the Son of Man says. And he tells Ezekiel, you are the Son of Man in this regard. And they're not going to listen to you, but if they don't listen to you, it's because they're not listening to me. Looking again at the watchman story, we've kind of gone over that, and the connecting to the book of Revelation, we've kind of gone over that. I gave just a few illustrations of Ezekiel and Revelation, the connections. So as you read this, let me tell you something. If you think Revelation is hard, it's because you don't know Ezekiel, and you don't know the apocalyptic literature of Daniel. You don't know the apocalyptic literature of Zechariah. You got to go back and read these prophets and see how God played those out and showed what those meant. Then you can read Revelation. You go, huh, yeah, I get that. I understand it now. Makes perfect sense. But most people are trying to read Revelation without first reading Ezekiel and understanding that. No wonder they're lost when they read the book. So we'll stop there. We've gone 45 minutes, so the crowd's getting restless. I see they're getting ready to throw stones, so we better quit. But I hope that this just kind of spurs you to want to go back and read the book and to see what God has done through this brilliant man, this wonderful man who was just a common man, but God could use even him sitting there on the river, by the river Kibar, talking to the people and giving them hope for the future. And that's our job, is to give hope to the future when we see the desperation of the things around us, to know that God's still in control and that God's working out history to his own glory. Thank you for your time.